So I guess my next question is, so you study them in the wild, and you obviously monitor them and study them in the big, what did you call it, the Ocean
Voyager exhibit. Yeah.
This is the one with that giant polymethylmethacrylate window. That's, how tall is that thing?
It's about 30 feet tall. It's about 65 feet long. It's one of the biggest viewing windows in the world.
Yeah, and in fact, I teach polymer science, so believe it or not, some of the polymethylmethacrylate on the inside, still curing. We use your window as an example when we talk about the theory of kinetics of polymerization.
I did not know that. The window is totally about cool. 2 feet thick. I know that.
Yeah, and they have a little model of it. They show the whole thickness thing. So, but the question is, do you learn things from the ones in the wild that will help you care better for the ones in the aquarium? And do you learn things from the ones in the aquarium to help you understand the ones in the wild?
In short, absolutely. It's a very reciprocal situation. So, and actually having some whale sharks in an aquarium setting has really allowed us to really jumpstart whale shark research in a way that wasn't possible before. So we're learning things from the field setting that really help us inform how we manage our husbandry in the aquarium, and we're learning some things from the husbandry in the aquarium about how we should be managing wild whale shark populations. So a good example would be diet studies. So we can go out to the field and learn what whale sharks are eating in the field and use that to inform decisions about what we should feed them in the aquarium. And similarly, we can study their feeding behavior in the aquarium and make extrapolations to fill in the blanks of those things that we can't work out from the field, because you can't follow a whale shark 24/7 in the field, but you certainly can in an aquarium.
Mm-hmm. So, for example, I mean, you observe that they eat fish eggs. They're eating caviar. But is that, too expensive to think about feeding the ones in the...
Well, I mean, I guess some of ours get fish eggs in the form of the fish. We do feed them some small fish. We feed them a diverse diet of different species of krill, which is the sort mm-hmm. of plankton that they would eat in the field. And we add into that some small fish, lance fish, and silver sides. And there's also a gel diet component that you can add vitamins to, and they eat that quite happily as well. So they get a very diverse diet, and it funds a very robust growth rate. They grow, 1 or 2 feet a year mm-hmm. in the aquarium setting. So that's your biggest sign that the animal is doing well, is when they continue to grow robustly and still have a good food drive. So.
Right.
How you said they're sort of essentially teenagers now. How old are they, and when do they mature to reproductive age?
Well, we don't exactly know. That's one of the big blank questions in the aquarium. We don't know for field populations, and we don't know for the specific animals that we have in the aquarium. They do tell you when they're coming into maturity. The males have they're called claspers, but just like anything else that hits puberty, those appendages get longer and more developed when they approach maturity, and ours have not got to that point yet. So it's possible that our females are getting there, because those are the two larger animals, and they're in the high 20s in length now, in feet. But the boys will tell us when they're ready, because their claspers will begin to, they call it differentiating, but they get bigger and the ends of them turn into broccoli. It's a remarkable transformation.
So I would think you'd also get some information from the aquarium exhibit itself about interaction of different species, because in the ocean's big. You never get to see lots of diverse species next to each other. I remember I was actually diving at the Living Seas in Walt Disney World, and now you have a program where you can dive in the big tank there. I'd like to talk about that in just a little bit, but there's an eagle ray next to a sand tiger shark, and people always ask me, because I've been diving for 25 years, how many sharks have you seen? Very few, because they're very rare in the open ocean. I saw six different species of shark that I could touch right in these aquarium exhibits, and you see, how does a whale shark deal with, I don't know, the great hammerhead shark. You have two of those in there as well.
That's correct. So we have this sort of natural lab setting in the aquarium. It's like a giant mesocosm, ecologists would call a mesocosm study, where you have, a replication of what you might get in nature, but it's a bit more condensed and a bit more controlled. So you can go in. We do have a dive immersion program where guests can come and swim with the whale sharks. They do stratify the exhibit a little bit, which is to say that the whale sharks spend most of their time at the bottom. Mm-hmm. At the top, rather. Mm-hmm. And everybody else spends most of their time at the bottom. So by snorkeling, you tend to see the whale sharks more. Mm-hmm. And by scuba diving, you tend to see the other animals. And we're not satisfied with just making those anecdotal observations. So we have something we call the Whale Shark Behavioral Observation Program, or WSBOP. And WizBop is our way of monitoring whale shark behavior. So we have a dedicated team of volunteers and staff who spend untold hours following the whale sharks from a high vantage point in the aquarium and writing down everything that they do. And then we put all those data into software that's for analyzing animal behavior. And that project is led by Dr. Matt Grober at Georgia State University. And we're able to learn about how whale sharks divide up their time and what happens when they interact with each other and with other animals in the exhibit. So those data are just starting to come out now. And we certainly see, you know, signs of individuality in these animals. You don't want to call it personality because that's anthropomorphizing a bit, but they are very different. We have Taroko, who's our shy guy. He sort of keeps to himself and is quiet. We have Yushan, who's the sort of rebel. He swims off differently from the others, and he tends to swim very fast, and he gets very amped up when it's lunchtime. And then we have Alice, who's, we call her the spotted love bus. She's one of the big females, and she sort of barrels around the exhibit, you know, clearing the path of everything in front of her. So they do have very independent and very individualized behaviors, and the people who work with the animals know that, but that's a far cry from making it scientific. And so we're very pleased to have this behavioral observation program that's turning those anecdotes into science and really leveraging this amazing collection into generating new knowledge, and that's a real thrill for us.
Instead of personalities, would you call it fish-analities?
I guess they'd be fish-analities, yeah. Or shark-analities.
Shark-analities, yeah.
Well, so what's interesting is, and this is how science always begins, right? I mean, it's how Darwin started. You make anecdotal observations, you make enough of those, and suddenly it turns into something fundamental that we just didn't know. So very slowly but surely, you may be learning things that were not known previously, as simple as they may be, like the way they swim, the way they behave. And I've talked to some of the folks in Mark Hayes' group here who I think have actually done some diving over at the aquarium, and they tell me that when they go in to clean the big window, right, they always got two guys, right? One guy's cleaning the window, the other guy's got like a broomstick. And he's basically there, what, to poke the hammerheads?
No, not really poke them. Those are the safety divers. When you're concentrating on cleaning a window, you can't be looking 360
right,
degrees. So
right.
they're there to be the eyes in the back of your head so that you can concentrate on working, and they can be there to fend off anybody who takes too much of an interest. It's actually more likely to be one of our big groupers that are very curious and tend to come over and check you out and decide whether they can fit you in their mouth or not, which of course they can't, but it won't stop them harassing you while you dive. So we have a safety diver there. It's really never been a big issue for us, but we prefer to err on the safe side because you are in their habitat and you need to be respectful of the fact that they have some capabilities.
Right. So you're less likely to fall victim to the hammerhead than you are to be, mouthed in an inappropriate way by the groupers.
That's a very good description.
By the groupers.
Yes, the hammerheads are quite flighty, actually. They're very sort of skittish shark, but just a phenomenal animal. Watching those animals cruising around in the exhibit is a real buzz for us, and you can't see that particular species in many places, so it's a privilege to be able to take my morning coffee in front of that big window and watch these animals do their thing, and that's actually where we make a lot of those sorts of anecdotal observations, is that's just the time and the exposure that comes from managing this collection 24 hours a day. So that's a real thrill.
All right. Well, we'll talk a little bit more about this topic after a quick break here. But again, if you've got a question or comment about anything related to the Georgia Aquarium or aquatic research, by all means, give us a call here at the studio. If you're listening to us live Wednesdays noon to 1, the number 404-894-2468. Once again, that number 404-894-2468. We'll be right back with Inside the Black Box, Science Only Funnier.